Hello everybody, this is Quinley. Today I would like to share with you a little bit about my life. I think my life is quite unusual and different compared to many of your lives, because the circumstances I came from were very different and very unique. So let me introduce the background a little bit. I was born in Vietnam on March 13, 1980, so I'm 26 now, and yes, sometimes my birthday does fall on a Friday the 13th. I was born with normal sight, but when I was 2 years old, I experienced some sort of high fever. The doctors kept reassuring my parents that everything would be okay, you know, as long as I take medications and as long as I get some got some needles. However, one day my parents came home from work and they found that I was trying to reach them with my hands and I was not successful. I was reaching over the place, and only then did my parents realized that I became blind. So like many parents, needless to say, my parents were very devastated. They took me to many, many doctors who used all kinds of methods to treat people, like acupuncture, superstition, used different medications, everything. And I was hospitalized on and off for probably 2 or 3 years. My parents spent a lot of money on me at that time, and perhaps because I was hospitalized for so long in the first few years of my life, that ever since I am quite healthy. I don't have any chronic illness, any disease. I have not had to be in the hospital or have not had to have any major surgery. Now, when I was 7, it happened that a school for the blind was created near my house. So my parents then enrolled me to the school, in the school for the blind. And in Vietnam, it was very different, at least when I was there. Blind people could only go to schools for the blind and only for a maximum of 4 or 5 years. In school, blind people would learn very basic academic skills such as Braille in Vietnamese, some basic math, basic literacy and things like that. And they would also learn some basic living skills. After 4 or 5 years, however, blind people would have to return to their home and be supported by their families. And if they did not have families, then the circumstances could become worse, if you know what I'm trying to refer to. So my parents knew that they wanted much more for me. And the only way they could do that was to take me out of the country and to bring me to a developed country like the US, Canada, and Australia, and those kinds of countries. You know, they knew that I would have more opportunities in terms of education, in terms of technology, and, you know, quality of life in general. Now, at that time, the way we would leave the country was to escape by boat. And escaping the country at that time was an illegal act. So if the government caught you, then they would put you in jail. And unfortunately, the first time my family tried to leave, we got caught. And so my mom, myself, and my sister had to stay in prison for 2 weeks. We were lucky because some of the children in prison got sick. So they decided to send all the women with children home. My dad, however, was not as lucky, and he had to stay in prison for a total of 6 months. So even though we were put in prison, my parents did not give up, especially my mom. She was very determined to take me out of the country. I think also another reason was she was hoping that, you know, my blindness can be treated in a developed country. And only did we come here that she realized that nothing can be done about my blindness. So the second time we left the country, my dad had to stay behind because he was still in prison at the time. And so only my mom, myself, and my sister went on the boat. Now, if you could imagine a very small boat, probably the size of my living room, of my bachelor apartment, and in it, the boat crammed 126 people. So we were like sardines, in this very small place. Another problem was the people who organized the trip, because they did not go along with us and they were paid by us to organize the trip. They didn't care much. They, you know, gave us very little food and water, so the supplies became low by the second and the third day. Also, the boat cracked and the engine stopped running. So we were floating on the ocean, and people had to continuously take the water out of the boat because otherwise it would sink. And my mom was telling me, you know, when she looked outside the boat, it was a very scary feeling because, you know, it was a huge, huge ocean and no land, no one was inside except for the people on the boat and our boat. And we looked extremely, extremely small on that ocean. It was very wavy too. The waves were very, very big, and that was why our boat cracked. And, you know, it was quite a surprise, a miracle that our boat did not break completely because of those waves. I remember, you know, some nights on the ocean, it was very rainy and very wavy and lots of thunder, and it was something. Now, we also ran into pirates. But in a way, fortunately for us, those were not professional pirates, because otherwise they would have killed us. They would have crashed our boat until it sank. They were merely greedy fishermen. So they came onto a boat and they robbed jewelry and lots of gold that we had. Now, you have to remember, because people left Vietnam and they never planned to go back, they sold every single property that they had. And so they bought gold as a means of property to bring along with them. So those pirates robbed everything they had, almost everything. Not only that, in front of all of us, including the kids, the pirates raped three of the girls on our boat. And I remember one of the girls was a very good friend of my mom, and she was raped by three pirates all at once. And, you know, at that time I was very young. I was only 9, and I didn't know what was going on, and of course I couldn't see either. So I remember I felt very restless because of the way she reacted. She was crying and screaming. And I remember I said to her, "Oh, don't worry, it will pass soon." But, you know, little did I know that what was going on. So then the pirates left us, and so we began floating on the ocean again, once again. Now, by the sixth day, we ran into this big ship. At first, we were quite scared because, you know, well, what if those people on that ship were pirates again? But no, they were very good people. They fed us, they gave us water, and they pulled our boat along the ship to a refugee camp that we requested them to bring us to there. That would have been in Indonesia. So by the time we arrived at the refugee camp, it was the seventh day. So we were on the ocean for 7 days, and because a lot of us went onto the deck of the boat because the inside of the boat just became too crowded and too much. That's why a lot of us were also burned pretty badly. Now, The life in the refugee camp was quite hard. We spent there for 5 years. And if you could imagine, you know, 3 cans of sardine per person for 1 month, 4 packages of Mr. Noodles for 1 week, 3 or 4 cups of rice a week, that sort of thing. So the food was quite scarce. And people supported themselves in different ways over there. Either they would do very heavy labor job, which my mom could not do, because those jobs often involved things like chopping up trees and building up houses for people, or digging up wells that were as deep as 10 to 15 meters, which was 30 to 45 feet. So of course my mom couldn't do that. My uncle did that. And if you could imagine, you would be down under this well, 10 meters or 15 meters below the ground, and trying to dig even deeper. So it was very scary and very risky. Now, another thing about a refugee camp was that we had to go through an interviewing process. And it was a very hard process. Only about 20 to 30% of people would pass the interview. And if we failed the interview, we would not be able to be accepted as a refugee to a developed country, and we would have to return to Vietnam, which would have been really bad, because the communist government in Vietnam would not treat us well as somebody who used to escape the country and now return to the country. So my family, unfortunately, we failed the interview, even though my mom's reason was to go to a developed country in order to improve the life of her blind child, but they were not sympathetic. So needless to say, my family was quite despair, and we thought we had to go back to Vietnam. But one day, I had to walk with my mom for 3 kilometers from one place to another, and it was an extremely hot day. It was really hot. If you could imagine 37 degrees Celsius or 40 degrees Celsius, I'm not sure what's Fahrenheit, is that probably 100 or more. It was so hot. So my mom decided to hitchhike a car. And the man in the car turned out to be the head of the interviewers. Now, I remember he was Dutch, and he was known to be the strictest, most serious man among those people. And he was also known to be quite non-sympathetic. However, when he met me and realized I was blind, he was very sympathetic. And he asked about us, whether we passed or failed the interview. Obviously, he didn't know who we were. And so he decided to change the decision. And that was a phenomenal story. It was a big turning point of my life. Nothing like that happened before on the refugee camp. If people failed, they failed. If they passed, they passed. Now the interviewing process was done in a very subjective way, because many people failed. And people who failed but had the money could engage in bribery by giving the interviewers money in order to pass the interview again. But for things like, passing the interview again without any money, that was a phenomenal thing. I remember the day we were told that we would leave the camp and go to Canada. My family, including myself, was ecstatic. I could not remember a happier day in my life. It was very emotional. I remember my mom cried, and because, at one point we thought we had to go back to Vietnam, and who knows what would happen to us. I think I would probably be happy like that if I ever win the lottery or something that big in my life. But so we came here in January 1994. Yeah, so It was the day that we came was very snowy. Oh, we had a snowstorm. And it was quite an experience, you know. I remember when I first got off the airport, they gave us boots and coats to wear. And if you could imagine, you know, both Vietnam and Indonesia are very hot countries. So I never saw snow. I never experienced cold in my life. And so I remember the boots that they gave me had Velcros on the, you know, on the outside of your legs. But I, however, put the Velcros kind of inside my legs. And so when I walked, the Velcros kept touching each other and they kept making noise. So then I remember one Canadian guy pointed at my mom and said, "Look, that girl was wearing the boots wrong, in the wrong way." That sort of thing. You know, so when we got on the streets, it was a very depressing feeling because not a lot of people were on the streets. It was, I think it was around 6 or 7 o'clock at night, in a winter night. And so not a lot of people were on the street, and all the doors in, you know, of the houses were closed, you know, which was quite different compared to where we came from, because the doors of people's houses are usually wide open in order to let some fresh air in and that sort of thing. Now, the way my family came here, we were sponsored by a very wonderful lady from Salvation Army. So she did a wonderful job, you know, helping us settle down. She looked for a place for us. She helped us buy things and, you know, taught us about the different paperwork and that sort of thing. I really regret not being able to keep in touch with her. She left town shortly after we came. And I guess because my family and I, we barely spoke English at that time, so we didn't make the initiative to keep in touch with her. I remember every time we saw her, we were like quiet creatures, and she kept talking on and on and on about different things for us to understand. She was a very wonderful lady. So shortly after I came, I got enrolled in a school for the blind in a small city in Brantford here in Ontario, Canada. And immediately I had many challenges, many difficulties that I faced. Because if you remember, I was in the school for the blind for only 2 years. And it was a sporadic type of education because, you know, I had to, well, my family was trying to leave the country and I was in prison and everything like that. So I didn't get much. And even if I did, you know, the things that I learned were quite limited. So when I came here, I was placed directly into grade 9. So I knew nothing about, you know, things like geometry, history, geography, science. It was very overwhelming for me. That was a residential school, so I had to stay in the school during the week, and I had to speak English the entire time because nobody could speak Vietnamese. So if you imagine, in many ways, I felt as if I was placed on a different planet because, you know, often I would feel very lost. Sometimes I even felt as if I was a deaf-blind, mute person because often I didn't understand what people said to me, and what I said to them, they couldn't understand. And the Canadian culture was also very different from that of my own as well. I remember I even had to learn to use forks and knives properly, and it was something. I don't think I would go through all of that again. So because of that, I struggled in class, and the teachers saw my struggle, and they were considering to put me in the most basic level. Now, at my school, there were three academic levels, you know, basic, general, and advanced, partly because there was a diverse set of students at my school. In addition to having different degrees of blindness, some students also had cognitive impairment. Now, if they placed me in the most basic level, it would have been a disaster because it would mean I would not be able to go to college, let alone university, and let alone trying to go to graduate school and to become a psychologist. But, you know, other teachers stood up for me and they said, look, you know, Queen's grade in courses like math was 100%, you know, science was an A range, and her music courses, her music marks were also excellent. So it seemed that courses that would require a great amount of English skills, that would give me a lot of trouble. So in the end, they kept me in advanced level for everything except for English. I'm not sure about the U.S., but in Canada, at that time, English class had about 60 to 70% of Shakespeare's component, and I had a very hard time understanding that author. I think even until this day, I can never understand his language. I think it was a good place for me to be in that school at that time, you know, because the people there were very nice, very patient towards my lack of English skills, and they taught me a lot. Also, I got to try different activities like snowmobiling, downhill skiing, cross-country skiing, you know, canoeing, baseball, goalball, and that sort of thing. And, you know, I miss doing those things now. But I also think that, you know, because everything was already accessible and accommodated for us, many of the students who graduated and then, you know, went on to go to college and university, they became quite overwhelmed because, you know, in the sighted world, not everything is readily accessible and accommodated, and you have to be able to express your needs and fight for those accessibility to be available. But I guess fortunate for me, I was not too overwhelmed. Like, I mean, you know, I have had struggles in college and university, but I have been able to find ways to overcome those struggles instead of giving up. Now, when I graduated from high school, I decided to get a guide dog. Unlike many of you, I was a terrible, terrible cane user. I could not cross streets walking in a straight line. I remember, you know, often I would hit a car as I was crossing, hit the car with a cane as I was crossing the street, and, you know, car would honk at me, and then in turn, that would make me even more anxious. I probably looked pretty drunk whenever I walked on the street with a cane. But, you know, in order to get a guide dog, you need to have very good all-name skills. And, you know, traveling inside, I was great. But traveling outside was another story for me. And I'm pretty sure the report written by my all-name instructor wasn't all that great either, even though she was quite fond of me as a person. But, you know, she had to be honest in her report. Now, the day that the staff from the guide dog school that I applied to, which was the Seeing Eye, came to see me, it happened to be a snowy day. So I didn't have to go out to show him how I travel with a cane. And I think if I did, he probably would not be impressed. So I got accepted, and I received my first guide dog. It was a big decision for me to get a guide dog because I was fearful of big dogs. I could not imagine myself trusting the guide of a dog. So, but you know, like many things, whenever I am uncertain about something, I would do research. And so I read books about guide dogs, and they were quite inspirational stories. I also called up schools to get information and that sort of thing. And I remember, during the first few days at the guide dog school, one day I woke up by a sound, and it was the bark of my dog, and she must have heard something outside the door, and she got temporarily excited. And oh my goodness, I was so scared. I just sat on the bed, didn't know what to do, because, you know, my dog was right underneath me. And so I told myself, okay, Quinn, you have to calm down because, you know, this is a well-trained dog and it's a guide dog. It's not going to bite you or become aggressive all of a sudden. Also, I remember, wow, that was my other dog. She breathed like a male human at night. So many times I would wake up in the middle of the night and I heard like a breathing person in my room. And it was really scary. It took me a while to get used to her breathing and occasional snoring. But unfortunately, she did not work out for me. I had to return her to the school after 8 months. She would urinate whenever she got excited, which didn't happen rarely, unfortunately. So now, then I got another dog, which is my current guide dog named Helen. And she's a golden retriever and she's really cute. A lot of people really adore her. So after I got a guide dog, I then applied for college. Now, college in Canada is quite different than university. There's a big distinction. In college, you can get a diploma, and it would take you 1 to 3 years, depending on the program. In university, however, that's where you can get a degree, and it would take you 3 to 5 years. Now, I couldn't apply to university right away because I didn't have advanced English. And I knew that my long-term goal was to become a psychologist and, you know, to go to university. So I would do anything to get there. So I went to college first for 2 years. And I think it was a very good step for me because it prepared me for university very well. Because many of the first and second year university students become quite overwhelmed by the demands in university. So a lot of them would fail many of the courses. I, however, gained some effective studying skills when I was in college. And so, you know, it helped me a lot. I have been placed on the dean's honor list in university throughout my university attendance, and even, you know, throughout the years, you know, the students, the average of tests and exams would say, you know, 67% or 70%, and I would get, you know, either A or A plus. So it does pay off. I think hard work really pays off in the long run. Now, there are many challenges that I have had to face in university. In the first 1 or 2 years in university, I mostly relied on books on tapes or in Braille. And those formats took a very long time to become available, long after my courses had started. So if you could imagine, because in university, there's a lot of reading and you cannot afford to fall behind without failing miserably and without receiving bad grades. So it was very hard for me. I had to scan textbooks and it was not easy because textbooks often contain all kinds of pictures, diagrams, text boxes that really interfere with the scanning process. Another challenge for me is that the psychology program at McMaster is quite science and research oriented. So because of that, I'm required to take calculus courses, statistic courses, biology, neurology, and those kinds of courses, which are very, very visual in nature. So because of that, I was quite apprehensive about choosing psychology as my major. I remember in my second year, a guidance counselor advised me to, well, actually two of them advised me to change my major to something like sociology and social work. But, you know, I didn't want to do that because I have always wanted to become a psychologist. And I knew that in order to do that, I would need to have a psychology background. But, you know, I received a lot of support from my family and particularly my boyfriend. They said, you know, look, Quinn, you have been able to overcome so many things. And, you know, these people, they don't know you well. They don't know how hard you can work. And they don't know, well, according to my family and my boyfriend, they don't know how smart you are. So in the end, I decided to stay in the program. And I'm very glad I did because, you know, those courses, well, not biology and neurology, but, you know, courses like statistics and calculus, I received either A or A pluses. That's because I worked really hard. You know, I received some tutoring, and my boyfriend would spend countless hours transcribing handwritten overheads for my math and statistic courses. He would also spend, write down all the descriptions for figures and diagrams in text so that I can review them later on whenever I like. Yeah, so he spent a lot of time helping me that way. And I think that's also a big part, a big reason, you know, why I was so successful in many of the courses. Now, he doesn't just help me with, you know, statistics and math. He also helped me a lot in my psychology courses too. And, you know, it's quite hard to imagine because he received a doctorate degree in Berkeley, I think Berkeley University in California. And when he graduated, he did not have to repay any student loan because he got throughout his university with all scholarships. So, you know, you would think that he's such a computer geek, but he helped me a lot with my psychology courses. And also he has helped me editing my essays. My essays I would edit and then he would edit and then I would go back and edit in case he misses anything. And, you know, ironically, even though English is not my first language, most of my essays are in either A or A pluses, so I'm quite happy about that. Now, because I plan to apply for a graduate schools really look for prior research experience. So because of that, I have gotten a lot of research experiences. And that was a big challenge for me too. Well, that has been a big challenge because it is still a challenge. The research done in the psychology department in McMaster are quite visually oriented because they do a lot on neural imaging, visual perception, you know, observing animal behavior, and those animals would include something like insects and rats and measuring hormones. So not only, you know, are they not my interest, but also they are very inaccessible for me and it would not be a good learning experience for me. I'm more interested in learning about people's behavior and people's lives, not so much about people's brains and animals' behavior. So I have resorted myself to seeking supervisors outside of the psychology department, such as psychiatry department or, supervisors working in hospitals and clinic settings who happen to be affiliated with McMaster University in one way or another. And, you know, I would approach them and explain to them, you know, what my interests are and what I can do as a blind person. Like I would explain to them, oh, you know, I would scan books. I would be able to easily locate articles, original articles from online journals, and you know, I would explain to them the different ways I do things. And you know, they have been great people, the people who responded to me. Those who, you know, of course not all professionals responded to me, but the ones that did, you know, were wonderful people. They were very accommodating, very reasonable in their expectations, and very nice people to work with and to have as your supervisor. So I've been very fortunate that way. And my research experience includes doing a project pertaining to people with mood disorders and their social support. I have done another one about youths who experienced child maltreatment and how that affects their self-esteem. And I have also worked with people with brain injuries, and that was a very rewarding experience because, you know, obviously those people had would have different levels of functioning, and I would find myself engaging in different styles in order to interact with those people. For example, those people who were who could not process information quickly, I would need to speak to them slowly, and would, you know, have more pauses between my sentences. That sort of thing. Okay, so what else can I tell you about university? Well, McMaster University is quite it's quite large. It has about 50 surrounding buildings, and you know, many areas would have sidewalks, but many areas would also not have sidewalks. And I tell you, you know, I cannot imagine myself navigating around that campus without Helen. Helen has been wonderful, and she is excellent in finding bus shelters. Also, because of Helen, I have made many good friends, and I have created many good contacts. You know, my supervisors also love Helen, too. So you might wonder, well, what else does Quinn do besides going to school and be a geek? Well, I also do a lot of volunteering. For example, I have worked at the local suicide crisis line, and that has been a very rewarding experience for me. You know, because it makes me realize what I will focus on for my career. I have also volunteered to work with international students, so to improve the English skills, even though my English is certainly far from being perfect. But you know, when I talk to those students, I would talk about how I would overcome, how I would get accustomed to Canadian culture and that sort of thing. And I would talk to them about everything, anything, to just improve their English skills. I have also volunteered for a peer helper program here in McMaster. And that program is quite competitive. You know, you have to go through two interviews, and you have to be an A student and that sort of thing. And I would help assess the student's skills by doing what they call a skill scan, you know, sorting cards and help them identify the different skills they have so they can think of them in terms of their career contacts, and also would help them write resumes and that sort of thing. So in general, I really enjoy university. You know, the fact that I have been able to get good grades has helped me receive scholarships every year, and also helped me become successful whenever I approach a potential supervisor. For example, this year we had to apply for a thesis for our next year, because you have to do that in advance. And if you could imagine, there were about 300 students in the psychology department trying to find a supervisor for their thesis. However, there were only about 25 to 30 supervisors altogether, external and internal supervisors. External means that they are not in the psychology department, they are in other department that can potentially supervise psychology students. Well, I approached two supervisors, and they were equally interesting. The reason I did that because, you know, we were advised to approach more than one supervisor in case they don't rank us as their number one. Because in the end, the way they do is they would match up the ranking. So if a student ranks a supervisor number one and that supervisor also ranks the student as number one, then they would be match up. So I approached two supervisors, and towards the end they told me both of them told me that they would choose me as number one, and of course I could only choose one supervisor for my thesis. So, you know, I felt very flattered, but in another way, it was very hard for me to say no to one of them. I think that's a cultural thing for me. Yeah, I have a very hard time saying no to some people. But in the end, I did have to say no to one of them, who was in another city. Yeah, she was in another city. And I would have to take a bus and a train to get there. And when you do a thesis, you would have to go to the supervisor's office quite often, because you would have to do, you know, have to meet the patients to collect data and that sort of thing. You know, I'm very grateful to be in Canada, because, you know, the life that I have here is very, very different from the life I would have had if I am still in Vietnam. You know, my family, I have a big influence on my family. You know, whenever they make a decision, they would call me up and tell me what they're thinking and see whether I think it's a good idea or not. I think partly because, you know, in my life, I have proved to make good decisions, and my family is very, very supportive of me working towards becoming a psychologist. They're very proud about it. Also, partly because I am relatively more educated than all my family members. My sister, she did go to college, and she majored in accounting, but now, you know, she's a housewife taking care of her two kids. Also, you know, I have proved to them that I'm quite capable. I moved out of my parents' place and lived on my own ever since I'm 18, so I'm 26 now. And, you know, I take care of my own bills and things like that. So my family is very proud and very supportive of me. And it also helps that my boyfriend is also very loving and very supportive of me. I've been with him for 5 years, and in those 5 years, his love for me has not diminished, if not increases. And I really love the technology here. I really enjoy technology. I love buying new things. Now, because I'm in school, a lot of the equipment are being funded by my school, as long as some academic justification can be shown. But I also buy other things with my own money. In fact, my boyfriend would call me a gadget girl because I would have, you know, different talking things in my apartment. Whenever my friends come over to see me, because all my friends are sighted, it just happened that way, they are often puzzled by the different sounds coming from my apartment, like a talking caller ID, you know, a watch that would chime every 1 hour, and a talking scale, and that sort of thing. And my nieces and my little sister, all because after we came here, my mom gave birth to another child. Yeah, so my nieces and my sister love checking out all the technical gadgets, like a talking scale. They love doing that. Oh, and, you know, a talking color identifier. So I'm very happy to be here, even though I went through a lot when I was younger. But, you know, in a way, it was a good thing because it makes me more appreciative of what I have today. And, you know, it's true that often, well, sometimes I would become very, I would become very despaired by all the struggles I have to face continuously, even daily, on a daily basis in university. Because, you know, sometimes you have professors that do not cooperate. And sometimes there are different deadlines that you have to meet, and it's not always easy to be a blind student. So yeah, I do face stresses a lot. But you know, when I think about what I did not have before I come here, it gives me a lot of strength. You know, it makes me very motivated to overcome those problems. I think when I deal with people, I don't have a confrontation approach. I believe in, you know, interacting people in a gentle and calmly manner, and just explain to them, you know, what you need in a very non-threatening manner. And that has helped me deal with a lot of professors, professionals, students, and so on and so on. You know, in the beginning, it was quite hard for me because originally I was quite shy and not very assertive at all. I think partly because I was a Vietnamese person, and, you know, in my culture, I guess we were not too assertive. But over the years, I have learned to be assertive without being aggressive, because I don't believe in being aggressive, because often it doesn't take you anywhere dealing with people. So I hope that you have enjoyed listening to what I have to share, and hopefully my story was not too sad. But, you know, I would like to say that I do have a happy ending now. In a way, sort of like a Cinderella story to me. I do have a happy ending now, and now I'm a very optimistic, very happy person. And I hope you will too, you know. I hope that my story can help you be aware of, you know, the hard lives that other people have in worse conditions. I know that being blind is very difficult sometimes. You know, trying to overcome the many problems we face on perhaps a daily basis, and trying to overcome the stereotypes and negative attitudes of other people. But I hope that, you know, when you have those experiences, you would think about other people whose experiences are worse than yours. And, you know, hopefully that will give you some strength and make you become more optimistic. And I think in turns that will help you overcome many problems. So if you have any comment or questions, you can certainly email me. My email is at QUYENLE at cocheco.ca. So I'll talk to you in the next podcast. Thank you for listening. Bye-bye.